Okay, this is part two of the two-part mini-series, The Once Over Lightly on Free Will. In the last hour, we talked about religious problems, how free will fits in with other religious concepts. Now I want to take you through a couple of scientific and philosophical challenges to free will and show you how we can deal with those. If you will talk to, I would say, almost everyone in the scientific community, especially those in what's called cognitive science, and probably a majority of philosophers, they will tell you that free will doesn't exist. Okay, let's ignore the philosophers because I can't take them as seriously as the scientists because I'm a philosopher. I know it too well. Well, let's talk about the scientists. They'll tell you that free will doesn't exist. Now, when a scientist tells you something like that, you have a right to ask him for his evidence. You know, it's a free country, and if he says something in the name of science, he's got to be able to back it up. And you should ask him for his evidence. He's claiming, he's making a very strong claim, there is no free will. How does he back that up? Can he, for example, explain in detail and predict what people do on the basis of purely mechanical principles? No, he cannot. So that can't be his reason. Nobody can do that. Can he chart all the workings of the brain and show that it works only on mechanical principles? No, he cannot. No one has even begun to try to do that. So if he tells you, well, we never found anything but mechanical mush in there, that just means he hasn't found it. It doesn't mean it isn't there. Indeed, they haven't found memory in there either. So there's a lot of stuff in there that he thinks is in there he hasn't found. So there's got to be lots of stuff he can't even imagine that's in there that he hasn't found. Now, here's a particular challenge. I'm going to take you through it twice. First time, oversimplified to show you how the argument works, and then the second time I'll make it more realistic and show you how it works again anyway. Imagine someone who tells us that you are programmed by your environment. Your native language is English because you grew up in an English-speaking environment. If you had been born in China, your native language would have been Chinese. The environment which you're in determines what language you learn. And so it is with all the rest of your development. All of it. All of it is produced by the environment. Okay, we have to be inclusive in the environment. That includes the intrauterine environment. The fetus learns in the womb. And the family and the topography. Born in the hills or in the deserts or the seashore. And the economy that you live in. And the culture of the people around you. And particular interactions with friends and neighbors. Wartime, peacetime. But if you take the sum total of the environment programs your entire development. You are what you are in every detail because of environmental program. The environment is the sole and complete cause of everything you become and everything you do. I said this oversimplified and unrealistic, but let's follow it out to see how the logic works, and then we'll go back and take a more realistic view. Now, we ask, as we have every right to do, you believe the environment is a total cause of everything a human being becomes and does? What's your evidence? Suppose he says, my evidence is statistics. Look, kids who grow up in Watts, California, by the time they reach 18, 75% are illiterate. Kids who grow up in Beverly Hills, by the time they're 18, 98% are illiterate. You see the difference in the statistics, and that shows you the effect of the environment. That's round one. Round two, I say, I see that there's an effect of the environment. I see an influence of the environment. I agree the environment definitely makes a difference, but that wasn't your claim. Your claim wasn't the environment is one factor in a person's development. Your claim wasn't that the environment has some influence on his development. Your claim was that the environment all by itself causes the entire development. You claim that the environment is the only cause and nothing else plays any role. How can a 75% statistic or even a 98% statistic be grounds for concluding that it's the only factor? Indeed, I might be inclined to say, if growing up in Watts means 75% are illiterate and 25% are literate, doesn't that testify to the existence of some other factor than the environment that's doing the job? Because these 25% are growing up in the same environment and they're coming out different. Now, the scientist has an answer to this, and it is absolutely crucial to see that the answer is incorrect. So I'm going to tell you the answer, and I'll explain to you why it's incorrect, and if it's not clear, let's stop and discuss it. This is absolutely crucial to see. He says, you're right, 25% in Watts grow up differently, but that's because there must be somewhere in their mini-environment, in their micro-environment, some difference that causes them to develop differently. Maybe in one case, he's there for a long time before the marriage is dissolved. He's the first child, so he has more time in a stable home environment. Or maybe one of his uncles is a school teacher. Or maybe he, unlike the vast majority, never got addicted to drugs. There's got to be something in the mini environment that explains why he turned out differently from the vast majority. And therefore, says the scientist, the entire explanation, as we said at the outset, is solely in the environment. You understand his response? Okay. Now let me show you why it's wrong. Because I'm asking the scientist for what he knows. I'm asking him for what science can justify. Science is based on evidence. If he says that the 25% turned out differently because of some factor in the environment, then let him show me the factor. Let him not just claim it's there. I don't interview scientists for their claims. I interview scientists for what they know and for what they have evidence. And let me give you a little clue to keep in your back pocket, which is very useful. When somebody says it must be so, it means he's really guessing. Where did you put your keys? If you say they must be on the table, it means you don't know. It means you're figuring it out. Listen, they're in my pocket and they're not hanging on the shelf. So they must be on the table, I think. Right? If you knew where they were, then you'd say, they're on the table. When he says it must be, it means he's figuring it out from someplace else, but he doesn't have any direct information. If he says, there must be something in the mini environment that makes a difference, it means, I can't tell you what it is, I haven't done the observations, I haven't done the correlations, I'm just pledging allegiance that it must be in the mini environment. Well, that's not science anymore. That's just his commitment to environmentalism, which leads him to opine, to guess, to hypothesized that it must be a difference in the mini environment when he can't show it to me. Because if he had really done the research, if he had really done the observations and the correlations, he'd be able to say, here's my statistic. Anyone who grows up in Watts and whose parents stayed together less than 4 years and who has no uncle that's a school teacher and who has flirted with drugs, all of them are illiterate, and it's 100% statistic. If he had done the environmental study and he knew the disturbing factors, he could list them and eliminate them and then come out with a 100% statistic. And he can't do that. So the conclusion remains, a 75% statistic does not support the conclusion that the environment does everything. It only supports the conclusion that the environment has influence. I agree it has influence. I think everybody has to agree the environment has some influence on how you develop, but that wasn't the question. The question was the environment the sole cause? And since he can't fill in detail the environmental factors that make the difference, he has not got enough grounds to conclude that the environment is the sole cause of development. Are we together so far? Okay, now why did I say this was dreadfully unrealistic? This is oversimplified. Nobody thinks the environment totally programs what you become, because I've left out your genes. I suppose if you sent a mouse to Harvard, it wouldn't learn Shakespeare, right? The genes have to play some role. A realistic naturalist will say, of course not the environment that totally programs what you become. It's the environment and the genes together that totally determine what you become. That would be certainly much more realistic. Good. What question do we want to ask? No, what's your evidence? The question to ask the scientist is, what's your evidence? Now he's got a different view. It is genes and environment together, totally programmed, totally determined, totally to cause everything that you become. Nothing else plays any role. What's the evidence? What's he going to do now? Take a genetic type, pair it with an environment, and get a 100% statistic? Nobody can do that, because nobody knows the relevant genetic types. Yes, they've mapped the human genome. That is to say, they can tell you at each spot what base occurs. But what those genes do, no one has a clue. If you want to invest in the growth industry, invest in trapping genetic effects on human development. That's going to be an industry for hundreds of years. Because each effect is brought about by dozens of genes working together. And then you have repetitions of genes. It's a mess. So if somebody says it's the genes and the environment together that totally determine your development, ask him what his evidence is. If he's honest, he'll tell you, I have no direct evidence of that at all. Okay. So then why do so many believe it? Here's why. Because they are committed to materialism. Materialism means there are tables and chairs and nothing else. Okay, there's Jell-O also, like the Jell-O in your brain. You know, there's soft stuff and hard stuff and things that are there and, only when you look, like electrons. It's all physical stuff. They're committed to that. Now let's see. If there's only physical stuff and you have these people running around doing things, what could possibly be the cause of the way they run around doing things? If there's only physical stuff. Well, the environment is physical stuff and it definitely has an effect. The genes are physical stuff and they definitely have an effect. Is there anything else that's physical and has an effect? Can't think of any. So it must be. Hear that? Must be. That's when he's guessing, remember? It must be that it's the genes and the environment together. That's not an adequate reason. In particular, if you ask him why he thinks there's only physical stuff, I think you'll get a big silence, or maybe some hot fudge sundae, but not the real stuff. What could lead someone to think that there's only physical stuff? Has he got a complete account of what everything physical does? Has he got any account of consciousness? Can he explain abstract things like numbers? No, he cannot. That's my field, philosophy. I know he can't explain those things. So that being the case, he certainly has no good reason to think that the world is only physical stuff, in which case he has no right to close the door and say it's got to be genes and environment. Must be genes and environment, which means I'm guessing. It must be genes and environment because I only recognize physical stuff. Why do you recognize only physical stuff? So this challenge is a challenge that should be straightforwardly confronted and rejected on the grounds that there isn't adequate evidence to accept it. Questions up to here? Okay. Let's take a little detail. Human intelligence. What produced human intelligence? They'll tell you evolution. Of course, if it's produced by a purely mechanical process, then presumably it works in purely mechanical ways. Is that a plausible thought, that human intelligence was produced by evolution? Let me quote to you here from the same philosopher I mentioned in the last hour, Thomas Nagel, who, as I said, I think is one of the best contemporary philosophers. By the way, he is a card-carrying atheist, so he's no ultimate friend of ours. But he is a friend because he's a clear, honest thinker, and he's willing to tackle the big problems, and he doesn't like fudge. Let's think how human intelligence was supposed to have developed in evolution. Must have been sometime in the last, according to them, 100,000 or 200,000 years. So human beings, according to many, started out in the trees, pre-human beings, and then they came down to the grasslands, the savannas, because of the retreat of the forests. What kinds of abilities would help them survive and reproduce? Well, the ability to tell the nutritious berries from the poisonous berries, and the ability to escape from saber-toothed tigers, and the ability to probably have social cooperation in order to hunt saber-toothed tigers, because one man against one tiger is not a good match. The ability to devise protection against the elements and to fashion tools Right? Intelligence is tested under those circumstances. An intelligence that creates better tools, like flint axes and sharper knives and twines, identifying twines that can be used to hold things and so forth and so on, that's the intelligence that gets you more babies. What has this got to do with mathematics? What has this got to do with figuring out how the sun shines? Or the origin of the universe? Or music? How does our human intelligence stand as a product of those forces? If we had exquisite hand-eye coordination, that you could understand. I can't wrestle a saber-toothed tiger to the ground, but if I can throw a sharp rock at its forehead, I might have a chance. So good hand-eye coordination will be something that's useful for me. But dealing with abstract things, you know, there's a wonderful cartoon of a primitive man drawing a figure of a triangle in the sand, you know, sort of making angles of things, and the saber-toothed tiger ready to leap out of the tree onto his back and kill him. You know, preoccupation with triangles is not going to be good in the jungle. It's not going to get you more babies. The conditions that produced our intelligence are so far removed from the range of our intelligence. Now, here's how the argument goes. Listen carefully. That when we use our intelligence for matters like abstract mathematics and science, there's no reason to trust it. There's no reason to trust it. Our intelligence has been designed to be reliable in identifying berries and making flint axes and twining twine together and cooperating to defeat the saber-toothed tiger. There's no reason to trust that tool in figuring out why the stars shine. It'd be sort of like saying they developed this knife to chop raw meat, and therefore it's perfect for surgery. I think you'd be very skeptical. If they developed it to chop raw meat, it shouldn't be good for surgery. Surgery is a very different function. If somebody offered you a knife on the grounds that it's been developed for chopping meat and offered you for surgery, I think you'd reject it sight unseen. You wouldn't even want to see it. You'd say, if that's the way it was developed, it's not good for my function. My function is an entirely different function. Somebody gives you a calculator that adds, subtracts, multiplies, and divides, you won't want it for doing square roots, because it wasn't designed to do square roots. Those are minimal jumps. Here you're talking about a gigantic jump. So if I thought human intelligence were really developed under those environmental conditions, I would have no reason to trust it in its abstract theorizing. Now comes the kicker. In particular, I wouldn't have any reason for trusting it to devise the theory of evolution. Which means that if intelligence were really developed as evolution says, then I would have no reason to believe my intelligence that tells me the theory of evolution, which means the theory of evolution is a self-defeating theory. It's self-defeating because if I believe it, then I have to believe I don't have any grounds to believe it. It's self-undermining, is the way philosophers would put it. Yeah.
Okay, so two things. One, like, so, based on what you said, though, wouldn't you say that if you can't trust it, then you can't trust anything that comes from it, right? So you can't trust any of the technology or any of that stuff that it actually does what it does, because you can't, you don't trust the premise of which you spell.
Yeah, but listen. You left off the premise. I'm not saying you can't trust it. I'm saying it follows from the evolutionary development that you can't trust it. My conclusion, of course, is that it didn't develop that way. I'm not saying you can't trust it. We know we can trust it.
And then couldn't you also say, though, if it did develop that way, it was, let's just say, the first person only had to first dealt with, you know, killing a tiger, catching a fish or whatever, making a sharp stone. Once that was already tackled, now the next person can think of the next one. The same way in mathematics, you don't learn how to do, you know, chaos theory before you can learn to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. So everything was just tackled in time. First you design a car, then you make a more efficient car.
But you understand that according to evolution, the way it's tackled in time is random variations and selection. That takes lots and lots and lots and lots of time. You know, a wing could take several million years. We're talking about going from the savannas to cosmology in tens of thousands. That's very implausible. On random variations and selective pressures, where the selective pressures are, did you get the right berries? And the result is figuring out why the sun burns, why the sun shines. It's not a plausible story. So this is another place where the naturalistic picture seems to be dreadfully unrealistic. Now, I want to take you through at least one of the many contemporary arguments about consciousness, because you need to appreciate how little is understood about consciousness to make room for the idea, as we said yesterday, of free will being a faculty of something that's beyond the physical. Let me just state a reference for you, which you might find interesting. There's a fellow named David Chalmers, who of course is not religious, and therefore everything he says is objective and well-researched and solid and reliable and credible. If you're religious, it's only propaganda. But since he isn't religious, you look at his website, and he's a hippie left over from the 60s. He's one of the world's leaders in philosophy of mind. In fact, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy online, which is free and is an excellent resource, he's their editor for philosophy of mind. He wrote a paper in 2002 called The Place of Consciousness in Nature. And he said, there are six theories of consciousness. Three say there's only the physical world. Three ways of fitting it into the physical world, but there's only your brain, your body, and the environment, and nothing else. Three say there's stuff beyond the physical world. And he says, the first three, the three that say there's only the physical world, are so bad, the objections against them are so conclusive, they're not worth developing. They're not worth developing. They're not worth thinking about. The other three, which say that the physical world isn't everything, at least are worth developing. They have a chance. One of the three is our theory, that there's a soul and a body that interact with one another. Now, I must tell you, this is sweet beyond belief. When I was in graduate school, in the Middle Ages, if you talk about the soul, they would laugh you out of the room. Give me a break. That's religious dogma. That has no philosophical standing, and so forth and so on. In 2002, to have one of the world's leaders in philosophy of mind say that our theory is one of the going theories that's worth developing, and the purely materialistic theories aren't even worth developing, is very sweet music to our ears. Does everybody agree with him? Of course not. It's philosophy. Nobody agrees on anything. But it can't be laughed out of the room. He's a very eminent philosopher in the philosophy of mind. Okay. Now, here's one of the problems. Science sometimes discovers what something is. This is a deep and dramatic kind of a discovery. What a thing is. We have a period of time where we don't know what it is, and then we discover what it is. Genes. Even Mendel knew that something's going on with the pea plants, you know. Take these and those, and you get 25% these, and 50% those, and 25% those, and it works that way over and over. Something's got to be controlling it, but what is it? He didn't have a clue. And then the genetic material was discovered, and the double helix was deciphered. So we know it's the DNA. He knew there was some carrier of genetic material, and they discovered what it was. Here's an example that Nagel gives, which is going to be very important for us. Let's take sound. What did people know about sound until 200 years ago? Well, they knew a lot about what makes sound, and snare drums, and lightning, which makes thunder, and falling objects, and creaking doors, and lots of things. Voice. And they knew that sound causes us to hear, to have auditory experiences. But what's the sound? What is the sound that's in between? And you know, sound behaves a lot like a physical object. For one thing, if you make a sound in a very tightly sealed room, people outside won't hear it. So it sounds like, it seems like, that the sealed room stops it, contains it somehow. And sounds bounce off walls, echoes. You make the sound here, and he hears it over there because there's a wall over there and it bounces. So the sound is behaving like a ball somehow. And the farther away you are from the source of sound, the weaker it gets. So it sounds like it's sort of diluting, you know, dying out. So it behaves as if when you bang the drum here and you hear it over there, there must be something in between. The trouble is, There doesn't seem to be anything in between. You don't feel anything, you don't see anything, you don't taste anything, you know? Your hair doesn't stand on end, and the papers don't flutter. I mean, the what? So, on the one hand, when you look at what causes it and what effects it has, it behaves like a physical thing. On the other hand, you don't have a clue what this physical thing is. It was a great discovery that sound is airwaves. Sound is airwaves. That was a really fundamental discovery. As Nagel puts it, if you ask somebody 200 years ago, how much does a sound weigh? He wouldn't know what you're talking about. Weigh a sound? How could you weigh a sound? We don't see them, we don't feel them, we can't put them in a box. I mean, you can't weigh a sound. Now we can weigh a sound. If the sound is the airwaves, you can weigh all the molecules and you could say that's how much the sound weighs. Sound weighs. So this was really a fundamental discovery of what a thing is. Heat. What is heat? Heat is random molecular motion. That also was a tremendous discovery. Wasn't always thought to be that way. In fact, originally people thought it was a fluid. And when you put a hot thing and a cold thing together, the fluid flows from the hot thing to the cold thing. That's why it warms up. This one cools down. And indeed, there was an earlier time when they thought there were two things. Heat and koof. There's an old English word, koof. C-O-O-L-T-H. Koof. There's hotness stuff and there's coldness stuff. And they sort of had an interaction with or a competition with one another. These were ideas people had about heat. No one dreamt that heat was jiggling. That heat is just moving. That was an idea that was, not even in the ballpark. Turned out, they discovered that heat is really random molecular motion. These are cases where the science discovers what a thing is. Now, it will be suggested to you, if you actually talk to scientists about this, that science has done a third such discovery. Science has discovered that experience is neural events in the brain. That's what experience is. Pain is certain firings of neurons in the brain. Just like sound is airwaves and heat is molecular motion, so pain is neural transactions in the brain. A number of philosophers have pointed out that there's a gross disanalogy between the cases. This goes back to work with Saul Kripke and Thomas Nagel and Colin McGinn and John Searle up to a point, and Frank, I don't think of his name, yeah, with the knowledge argument. It's a whole bunch of philosophers. And here's the disanalogy. I'm going to say this a couple of times because it's a little subtle and I want to make sure we get it across. Let's say again how it works in the cases where it works. I got this thing X. What do I know about X? I know what makes X. And I know what X does. My problem is, in between the making and the doing, there's this slot of X, and about what's in the slot, I know nothing. I don't know anything. I don't know anything about what's in the slot. I just know about what makes the thing in the slot and what the thing in the slot does. The sound. It can be contained in a room, and it can be reflected off walls, and it causes certain auditory experiences, and it's made by banging drums and avalanches and... That I know about what makes it and what it does. What's the thing in between? Nobody had a clue. Nobody had a clue. Maybe it's invisible rays. Maybe there are leprechauns blinking arms. Who knows? Maybe it's invisible jello. There was no hint of what the stuff is in between. The stuff in between was a complete blank. And when science discovered that it's airwaves, that was a big surprise. No one even guessed that it could be airwaves. How did they verify that it's airwaves? Well, since all I know about it is what makes it and what it does, just check that the airwaves are always there. When you bang the drum, does it make the airwaves? When the avalanche falls, does it make the airwaves? When the person's talking, does it make the airwaves? Can airwaves be stopped by a sealed room? Can airwaves bounce off a wall? Do airwaves get weaker and weaker as they go further and further from the space that made them? Do airwaves, when they hit your ears, cause auditory experiences? What you do is you check. This, for the give it a term, it's called a functional definition. I define it by its function. I define it by what it does. I don't know what it is. I know what it does. Somebody comes along and says, I think X is marshmallows. Well, let's check. Do marshmallows do all the things that X does? If marshmallows do all the things that X does, then marshmallows it is. That's how you check and you verify that the thing that's suggested is really the thing you're looking for. They say airwaves are the one things that do it. So you check. And in particular, when you drop something on the moon, there's no sound because there are no airwaves. Good, that's what we want. You don't have to go to the moon. You can make a vacuum in a vacuum chamber and you can try it that way. Air moves at a different speed underwater because there's water waves. And therefore, you have confirmation that it's the waves in the material that's being disturbed, which is more confirmation for the idea. So, to say it for a fifth time, I know what it does. I haven't a clue what it is. And therefore, I can verify that I've got it by checking what it does. Now let's think about pain. Where are we with respect to pain? Well, there is an analogy with sound. There is an analogy. It's only that, as I'll try to convince you, it's a partial analogy. So let's start with the part that is analogous. We have a lot of information about what causes pain. Someone steps on your toe, causes pain. And sunburn, and rashes, and extreme cold, or extreme heat, and physical pain. Twisted muscles. Swelling in the skin, or in the joints. We have a lot of information, tooth decay, about what causes pain. We have a considerable amount of information about what effects pain has. For example, somebody stepping on your foot could result in losing his balance as you respond to stepping on your foot, or something like that. Or certain speeches, you know, like ouch, or yelling and screaming in pain, or getting an aspirin, or going to the doctor, or complaining, or... We have considerable experience about what causes pain and what effects pain has. Now, says our friend the scientist, reflect. All the causes of pain hit you at your nerve endings. Right. And the nerve endings communicate impulses to the brain. Right. And the effects of the pain come out of the brain. They're usually motions, which are dictated by firings in the brain. Right. So isn't the brain the thing that's in between the causes and the effects? Gosh, it does look that way, doesn't it? He steps on my toe, so then, and then my arm interferes with his balance, right? Are we on the same page? That's a punch in the nose, right? We're talking the same language? Okay, good. All right, he steps on my toe, I punch him in the nose. Now, isn't the brain in between? The step on the toe causes a neural impulse up into the brain, and then the signal for the arm to swing out comes from the brain. So the thing that's in between is stuff in the brain. Isn't it obvious that that's where the pain is? I know what causes it, the step on the toe. I know what it caused, the arm swinging out. And the nerves connect up in the brain. So obviously, the thing that takes you from the cause to the effect is something happening in the brain. That's, now maybe I haven't pinned down exactly what's happening in the brain, but one could say this much, that it's something happening in the brain. That's as far as the analogy goes. But there's a great disanalogy. There's a great disanalogy. And the disanalogy is this. With respect to pain, I know too much. Listen carefully. Those whose trained reflexes say, we'll figure it out eventually. I'm not appealing to ignorance now. I'm appealing to knowledge. With respect to pain, we know too much. We also know something about what's in the middle. It's not just a blank. It's not just an X. We know how the pain feels. In fact, we know that the pain is a feeling. So it's not just a blank you can fill in any way you like on the grounds that the thing I fill in does the same job. I also know what the pain feels like. To say that the pain is something going on in the brain, it's not enough to say that steps on the toe cause it and it causes a punch. I got to say that the feeling of pain is in the brain. This you don't have with sound, and this you don't have with heat. This is an additional element. And here's where it gets stuck. What would it mean to find a feeling in the brain? A feeling. The feeling, the kind of thing that you can find in a physical object, in a physical location? Here, what's argued is, Not that we haven't found it yet, and not that we just have to look some more, but the words don't mean anything. As far as we understand what a feeling isn't the sort of thing that you can find in a physical object. Let me illustrate this by a comparison, then I'll go back and try to make the point directly. Suppose someone tells you he's applying for a federal grant for a research project. You say, really? What's the project? He says, well, I'm on a discovery search. I'm searching for the number six. Listen, I've already got some experience, so I think they'll be impressed. I've tried Nebraska, and it's not there. So next I want to try Wyoming. So I want a small grant. And if I don't find it in Wyoming, then I'll go for a big grant and try all the United States. And if we don't find it there, we'll try Africa. Do you think he's going to get the money? Doesn't looking for the number six in a location sound a little funny? Is the number six the kind of thing that you could find even in East Anglia? I mean, of course, I haven't tried the seabed yet. Maybe that's where we should try next, you know, or the core of the Earth. Well, there's the whole solar system, you know. We could make a really big project out of this. Start looking for the number six on the moon, and the number six isn't the sort of thing that's in a location. It's just not that sort of thing. Physical objects are in locations. Numbers aren't in locations. Numbers don't have sizes. They don't have colors. They don't have densities. They don't have weights. And they aren't in locations. If somebody says, you're just trying to stop scientific research, you know. You're one of these people who gives up too early. We just have to try harder. Let's look, you know, a mile underneath the Earth's soil. Maybe that's where it is. It's not a question of doing more research. It's a question of trying to think about the problem and figure out what kind of research is relevant. Looking in more places isn't relevant to finding the number six, because the number six isn't the sort of thing that can be in a place. Now let's imagine looking in the brain to find a pain. So here I go. I peel back the cranium, and there's all this gray mush. Right? Shall I dissect it, you know? Here's a little piece that's dark gray. Here's a little piece that's olive colored. What will I see to see that it's a pain? What appearance will it give me? Okay, I come with something that measures electricity. And there's electrical activity over here, and some more over there, and scattered electricity over there. What's it got to do with pain? Chemistry, you know, the electrical activity is the exchange of ions at the synapses. Okay, so I plot it on the molecular level, and it's a stream of ions going this way, and streams of ions going that way. That's right, the streams of ions going. What's it got to do with pain? What would count as finding the pain in the brain? Don't make a mistake. What do scientists actually do? They watch the brain and they ask the guy, are you feeling pain? Now let's say he says yes. And they say, oh, when he says yes, this part lights up. Try somebody else. Look at that. When he says yes, that part lights up also. Then you're finding what's correlated with pain. That's not the same as finding pain. As Searle puts it, lightning and thunder are pretty strictly correlated. That doesn't mean lightning is thunder, and it doesn't mean thunder is lightning. All you know is that when he's in pain, this part of the brain lights up. That doesn't mean the brain's lighting up is the pain. You can't go from correlation to identity. That's not a logically sound move, and it's not a scientifically sound move either. So asking him, do you feel in pain, just tells me that the brain is correlated with pain. Everybody agrees to that. Nobody's denying that. We're asking whether what goes on in the brain is the pain. Some people have put the argument this way. Imagine visitors from outer space. Now, they're obviously very intelligent. They have an advanced technology. But they don't have the same sensory system that we do. Different sensory system. They perceive invisible light instead of the visible spectrum. And, you know, they move by echolocation like bats instead of the way we do and things like that, or senses that we can't even imagine. Now imagine one of those advanced creatures doing a complete workup on the human brain. Takes it apart, neuron by neuron, and he can map 100 billion interacting elements simultaneously. Of course, he can't. He needs more than the whole universe as for computing. But this is science fiction, right? He maps the whole 100 billion neurons interacting and so forth and so on. Will he be able to discover, just by looking at the brain, that we have visual experience? What will tip him off? What will clue him? All he sees is that when the light hits the retina, these cells change in a certain way, and those impulses are passed up to the brain where certain changes take place. Yes, he'll be able to chart this machine operating perfectly, but in addition to the machine operating perfectly, there's the feeling, the experience. Where in the mechanics of the machine is he going to see that there's an associated conscious feeling? Another way to put the same argument. There's a lot of philosophical writing about zombies. I know that sounds weird, but the philosophers are weird. Right? They're writing about zombies. A zombie is someone who's just like you and me in all his physical structure, down to the atom. Every atom is the same, like you or me, but doesn't have experience. He's just a body without experience. Is that possible? Well, no one has ever thought of a reason why it's not possible. Why not? We have bodies and we have experience, but as far as we could tell, in fact, there used to be a famous problem in philosophy called philosophy of mind, how do I know that you have experience? Maybe you're just a very, very complicated robot. I can't peer into your mind, after all. I can just look at your body. So if I can't know that you have experience, then for all I know, there could be a human body structured just like mine without experience. Of course, when you step on its toe, it will say, ouch. It has all the same neural connections. That's the neural connections that determine the ouch. Quite right. But maybe there's no experience going together with it. Once you realize that a zombie is possible, there could be a human body without experience, then when you look into somebody's brain, how are you going to see that he's not a zombie? All you see is the brain. Since you know there could be a brain without experience, and all you're seeing is the mush, all you're seeing is the neurons, all you're seeing is the ions, all you're seeing is electricity, how are you going to get to, in addition to the mush, there's also experience? There's a disconnect here. So, to summarize the argument, discovering what sound is and discovering what heat is depends upon ignorance. It depends upon the middle slot being totally empty. I know what causes sound, I know what sound's effects are, but I haven't a clue what sound is. That leaves the stage open for anything I like. Put it on the stage and let it perform. If the thing you put on the stage does everything that sound does, you have a right to call it sound. Because your stage is blank. Whenever the stage is blank, you can go through this type of scientific discovery where you discover what a thing is, whether it's sound or the genes or heat or other such things. The problem with a conscious experience is that we know too much. The stage isn't blank. We know what causes conscious experience, we know the effects of conscious experience, and we know what conscious experience feels like. We know a crucial, essential element in the thing that's got to fill the stage. Now, when somebody says your conscious experience is in your brain, I have two things to check. Number one, does the stuff in the brain function the way conscious experience does? There, the answer might be yes. Might be no also, but it might be yes. But I also have to check whether the feeling of the experience is in the brain. And there, we're up against something like numbers. We have no way to explain to ourselves what it would mean to find feeling in the brain. The brain isn't the sort of place that you find feeling any more than Nebraska is the kind of place where you find numbers. This situation is so desperate that Thomas Nagel says, what we will need to solve this is a conceptual revolution. As our concepts are presently structured, it is impossible for us to imagine, to explain, to understand what it would mean to find. So let no one say, but we just have to look more. We just have to get more research grants and do more research. That's like looking for the number six in Australia, the last continent you haven't tried. It's so far as we can describe it, it's the wrong project. Therefore, the universal, almost universal commitment to the idea that conscious experience is just brain events is very easy to question and undermine. And I would say the best contemporary philosophers are convinced that we don't have a solution. Colin McGinn actually goes so far as to say that he believes we can't have a solution, that it's beyond the capacity of human and intellect to have a solution. And since he's at Oxford, I guess he isn't exactly dumb. You had a question? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now, what this indicates is that consciousness, as Chalmers says, has got to be someplace else. Got to be. The evidence that we have and the understanding that we have places it someplace else. Now, if you say that it's in the soul, then, of course, as I said yesterday, you have room for free will. You have room for something which is not controlled by physical factors. I will just make one final comment about this. It was an argument that I came upon about 15 years ago, and I was very pleased to see that Chalmers uses the same argument in his 2002 paper. He didn't get it from me because I didn't publish it, but I think it's a very important argument. People will tell you, I know they'll tell you because that's what I was told when I was in graduate school, you're telling me there's a soul and there's a body and they interact. That's really weird. How can a physical thing like the body interact with a non-physical thing like the soul? How can they have any contact? How can they affect one another? Isn't that just impossible to imagine? Doesn't that defeat the idea right at the outset? No, it doesn't, for the following reason. The truth is, we don't have a clue how physical things interact with one another. Causation is a big problem in philosophy. Ever since David Hume's critique of causation, there's no understanding of what causation means for billiard balls. New books come out on the subject every year, which of course is bad. It means nobody's got a theory that everybody agrees on. And it's an outstanding problem about which there's a great deal of confusion and contradiction. So, if we don't understand any causation, why should we be defeated by saying we don't understand causation between the body and the soul? So, you'll be told, yeah, but at least with the billiard balls, we see it. We can see the one thing affecting the other thing. Okay, it's a problem how to understand it, you're quite right, how to define it, how to picture it, how to analyze it. We don't know how to do that, but we at least see it. Well, the response will be, we also experience body-soul interaction. Listen, I decide to raise my hand, and my hand goes up. Isn't that an interaction between the soul and the body? I'm leaving out what I said yesterday about God causing everything. He steps on my toe, and I feel the pain. Isn't that an interaction between the body and the soul? If seeing it happen is enough reason to believe it without being able to understand it, then I have enough reason to believe in body-soul interaction because I experience it all the time, far more than I experience physical-physical interactions. If the inability to understand it disqualifies it, then we can't believe in it for billiard balls either. The problem of body-soul interaction is not a reason to give up the view that we are espousing. Question? We are affirming, agreeing to. Right. I'm sorry, I said, yeah.
It seems as though you're taking the logical holes in the problem of causation and you're inserting into the hole or holes the notion that we have a soul.
No, no, I'm not doing that. But here's what I'm doing. When you have a discussion about a point, it's really important to know where the burden of proof is. I'm putting the burden of proof on the other side. I said, if you talk about free will, if you talk about consciousness, talk about the soul, they will tell you we know you're wrong. Okay, I want to know how they know. One reason they give to rule out a soul is you're talking about interaction between a physical thing and a non-physical thing. That's verboten. That's impossible to understand. It disqualifies your view. So I say, I don't believe that you have a reason to disqualify my view. I'm putting the burden of proof on him. Right? He says he can rule me out. So I say, to rule me out, you're using causation. You're using it. will notice that your use of it is really unqualified. It's incompetent. Because you can't explain what it is. You know very well you don't understand causation, even for physical things. How then can you use causation to rule me out? I'm not creating the soul to fill the gaps. I'm saying if I have I believe in a soul, and you want to criticize me, and you want to use causation to criticize me, then you better know what you're talking about when you talk about causation. Otherwise, you can't use it to criticize me.
So you're putting your belief on the same level as their belief because they are not able to prove their stance on like physical interactions.
You're going too far. I'm making a very limited comment. He's trying to show me that I'm wrong, and I say he's failed. Does that mean I'm right? No. Does it mean my belief is reasonable? No. It just means this particular attempt to show me I'm wrong has failed. That's all. That's all I'm saying. I'm not drawing any conclusions about the overall status of the thing. I'm just saying this attempt to show me I'm wrong has failed.
So based on the fact that they haven't been able to come up with a position which is more right or which has more evidence than yours...
No, that's not it at all. He's claiming I'm taking a position which is impossible. What's the impossibility? That a physical and a non-physical thing interact. There's nothing to do with evidence. My position is that a physical and non-physical thing interact. That's my position.
Yeah.
I haven't said any reason why you should believe it. That's my position. He says, I'm going to rule it out.
Right.
Why am I ruling it out? Because physical and non-physical things can't interact.
Right.
So your position is saying something that's impossible. I say to him, to show me it's impossible, it's impossible because physical and non-physical interact. That's what's impossible about it, you say. Well, I want to know, what do you understand about interactions altogether? How do you describe interactions? How do you analyze them? What do you think makes interactions? If he says, I don't know, then he hasn't got a very good objection against me.
So he can't rule it out because he just doesn't know about interactions in general.
That's right. He hasn't got any account of interactions in general, so how can he say that this type of interaction is impossible?
So you're saying something more about the argument itself rather than just the conclusion.
Correct. I'm only talking about the argument. I'm saying this argument against this is not a good argument. But the status of the conclusions is up for grabs. Just this argument isn't a good argument. And I do that by way of illustrating to you that there are very popular arguments that many people will put to you that aren't worth much. And therefore, when you go back to university and you'll hear other arguments that I haven't had time to discuss, you'll at least have a little caution and a little distance to say, okay, I heard two and they were terrible. I hear this one. Let's give me some time to reach them. You can send me an email, which you can get through from my website. And, we can talk about the other ones as well. Or you could listen to the tapes that are on the website. There's a 5-tape series on free will. Yeah.
I don't know if this is like into the subject, but can thought create things?
It's not really directly into the subject. And I believe, I'll just answer this and I've got to quit. I believe that with respect to science, there's a great deal of prejudice and bias, and what we ought to try to promote is an open mind. Many people will tell you, no, that's baloney, it's impossible. Why say that? Who knows? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. After all, in quantum mechanics, it isn't there till you look, and when you look, it pops into existence. Now that's not creating out of nothing, but certainly changing its very character by your mind, or maybe yes, or maybe no. There's a lot of controversy about it. Why not just be open-minded about these things? I hear people tell me, we'll never understand everything. I don't know. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. Who says so? Just keep an open mind and watch things develop. But people tell me, science really basically understands everything. That's certainly not correct, right? Look at what's going on in science, and you'll see that that's certainly not correct. Just be open-minded and let the chips fall where they may. Why should we prejudice the development of science by saying it'll turn out this way, it'll turn out that way? Yeah?
Just to make a comment on this, people can change things with our mind. There were some experiments done on water, where the people were thinking good thoughts, looking at the glass of water, and then they froze the water and examined its structure. And the structure, according to different sources, was different. The person was thinking bad thoughts, right? The structure was completely like square. Uh-huh. But the person was thinking really good thoughts, right? The structure was completely perfect. And the perfect structure was actually Magendowitz.
So, see, this is the kind of experiment that needs to be done. It needs to be done, it needs to be replicated, it needs to be verified in different laboratories and make sure that the variables are done correctly. Some of you remember cold fusion, which was all the rage for about 8 months, and then it turned out that there were various mistakes that were made, and it didn't turn out to be right. But this is what has to be done. Experiments like this have to be done to see whether it can happen, whether it can't happen. One should be open-minded about these things. One shouldn't be doctrinaire one way or the other.